Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Happy to have you listening this morning. We now know that California Senator Kamala Harris is Vice President Biden's choice of a running mate. They'll appear together in Delaware today. Now, if you're trying to remember how many women have been vice presidential nominees for a major party ticket, you may want to brush up a bit on your Minnesota history. There is Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who was announced right here in St. Paul in 2012 at the GOP convention.
She's got the grit, integrity, good sense, and fierce devotion to the common good. The next vice president of the United States, Governor Sarah Palin of the great state of Alaska.
I will be honored to accept your nomination for vice president of the United States. I accept the challenge of a tough fight in this election, and I accept the privilege of serving with a man who has come through much harder missions and knows how tough fights are won, the next president of the United States, John S. McCain.
In fact, former Governor Palin sent a friendly message to Senator Harris on Instagram yesterday, warning her to follow her instincts and not to forget the women who came before her. And of course, there's the woman that Minnesota's favorite son, Vice President Walter Mondale, chose to be his running mate in 1984, Representative Geraldine Ferraro.
Tonight, the daughter of a woman whose highest goal was a future for her children talks to our nation's oldest party about a future for us all. Our faith that we can shape a better future is what the American dream is all about. The promise of our country is that the rules are fair. If you work hard and play by the rules, you can earn your share of America's blessings. Those are the beliefs I learned from my parents.
But if you think the gender-based skepticism that confronted both Ferraro and Palin is somehow gone because it's 2020, I don't think you've been paying enough attention to the BS being written about how this woman is too ambitious and that woman is too eager for the job and this woman didn't apologize. Politics writer Joan Walsh recently wrote in The Nation, if a woman is ever to occupy the Oval Office, it seems, even 100 years after we won the vote, she will have to spend some time directly apprenticing to a man, living at a safe distance from actual power at the Naval Observatory. And whoever gets the nod from Biden has had to endure the same sexist stereotyping, as did the women senators who had the audacity to run for president against Trump, as Hillary Clinton did in 2016. So today's conversation is part of our August series, What It Means to Be a Woman in America. And as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you on some gender polling questions that I took from a Pew Research poll. So think about this as our conversation develops this morning. Do you think men or women leaders are better at being persuasive in a political setting? Do you think men or women leaders are more comfortable with taking risks? Those are some questions to think about as we again renew our conversation about women as political leaders. And here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. Do you have a view on whether men or women leaders are better at being persuasive in a political setting? Do you think men or women leaders are more comfortable with taking risks? 800-242-2828. and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Ange Marie Hancock Alfaro is a professor and chair of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California, and she's joining us this morning from L.A. Professor, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Andre Gillespie is going to join us a bit later from Emory University. Professor, Politico Magazine kind of took up this question that we're contemplating today, which is what has really changed since 2012 and since 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro stepped into the political spotlight. And there was an interesting reflection here from a political scientist at Ohio State University, Treva Lindsay. She said about Harris, her demeanor, her delivery, her personal life will be under the same microscope as other women who ran for executive offices. Commentary about her personality and her likability will comprise an excessive amount of the conversation about her candidacy. As a woman of color, the interconnected weight of racism and sexism will undergird reactions to her speeches, her debate style, and how she engages both her allies and adversaries. Take that apart a bit. Do you think this analysis, are we already seeing some evidence of this analysis about the way Kamala Harris will be regarded, not just by the media, but also by the voters?
Well, I think what Professor Lindsay is talking about is decades of research on women candidates when they've run for higher office. And there are kind of two really interesting points to think about. First, Professor Lindsay is correct that there is this general kind of different standard for women running for office, right? No matter how qualified, no matter how, you know, eminently ready they are for the higher office, women candidates are actually much more likable, meaning voters like them much more when they're already in office. But when they aspire to higher office, their likability goes down. And so I think that is definitely one of the undertones we heard in the comments about Kamala Harris prior to her being named the candidate, you know, for the nominee for vice president. So I think that's one thing that does absolutely happen. Voters seem to like women when they're in office, but when they're running, they're not nearly as likable.
I have to talk about that. I mean, what is that really about? It is about being uncomfortable with the idea of open ambition? Is it about, you know, women ought to know their place, and once they've broken that barrier, then we get more comfortable with it? What do you attribute to that?
I do think that there is a general cultural discomfort with women being equally ambitious. And some of the research on women's leadership more generally states it kind of this way. We have in our minds, most of us carry around the prototype in our heads of what a leader looks like. And that leader prototype tends to be a male prototype, you know. And so when a woman becomes a leader, that breaks the stereotype. We also have a prototype in our heads of who's a more likable kind of person. And because women are socialized to be more relational, to focus more on how we navigate relationships, we end up having that prototype of what a likable person is. And so you have these two stereotypes, and when you have a woman leader, it's difficult for them to navigate that idea that they can both be a leader and be likable at the same time. I think that's also what's going on.
Forgive me for interrupting you there. I think what you were saying about the prototype, I think a lot of us would want to think that we are no longer influenced, right, by these really deeply social conditioned prototypes. But it's very difficult to separate yourself from, again, the kind of social psychology that I think we're surrounded by from the time we're young. I mean, I think many of us would want to say we are beyond that. We've progressed beyond that. But women discover on the campaign trail exactly what you're describing. Although I think voters would want to believe that we're not still enmeshed in those kinds of old ideas.
Yeah, I think you're right. So the studies and the research, this finding holds across sectors. So this is true in the political science research. It's also true in corporate research about women corporate leaders. So this disconnect between likability and leadership is absolutely something that we do see as deeply embedded, even in folks who think of themselves as feminists or think of themselves as progressive about gender ideas. Some of these findings also go back to boys and girls as early as 9, 10, 11 years
old.
Wow. And so, again, you know, this is deeply ingrained, meaning we learn it even before we know we're necessarily learning about gender. But what I do think has changed was the reaction. And so I think a lot of people were, you know, very upset about the reports of what Christopher Dodd was saying about Kamala Harris last week as a member of Joe Biden's search committee. And I think the response, even though we might all carry those prototypes around, I think the response is what's changed. And so I think, you know, partly folks were like, oh, my gosh, how did that escape from the campaign? I wouldn't necessarily rule out that it was a balloon that was floated by the campaign to see how the public would respond at the idea that Kamala Harris is too ambitious. Under, I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, that's really, that's interesting. Under Chris Dodd, so Chris Dodd gets to be the Neanderthal who doesn't get it, huh? So they
absolutely.
Let me grab a call here from Olivia in North Dakota. Hi, Olivia. I'm glad you called in.
Hello.
Hi. What are you thinking about?
This question, I guess, made me feel or have to confront my own kind of bias with this.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been proven that the taller somebody is, the better leader that they're perceived to be, or
yes,
the lower their voice.
Exactly.
And women's voices, like, I even find myself, like, reeling sometimes from shrill voices and having to be like, why is this is just my own discomfort with, you know, aging or my own femininity or something. But I've seen some of the most compassionate leaders and persuasive leaders be women. And I think that, you know, it's all a generalization because there are very sensitive, empathetic, and, you know, socially adept men. But obviously women are socialized to be more responsive to cues that I think men sometimes are rewarded for ignoring.
Yeah, I mean, Olivia, you are touching on exactly what Professor Alfaro and I were talking about. Professor, this is something that Kamala Harris was thinking about, I think, when she spoke to some young Black women recently. She told them, there will be a resistance to your ambition. There will be people who say to you, you are out of your lane because they're burdened by only having the capacity to see what has always been instead of what can be. But don't let that burden you. I think she's speaking right to what you've shared with us so far this morning, don't you?
I do. And I think to Olivia's point, there are decades of research. Deborah Tannen has done a lot of this research about the differences in how women and men communicate. And again, we're talking in generalities. We're not talking about every single woman and every single guy. But the idea is that, again, based on the ways in which women are conditioned in childhood, as teenagers and as young women, they end up having certain communications patterns, right? So there are certain phrases that women will use versus men. I don't know if this is right or maybe. Another thing is, you know, their voices will go up at the end of a sentence. It's almost as if they're asking a question, you know? And so again, we've seen some of these gendered patterns. And what's interesting in what Senator Harris is saying is that she's saying, and when you violate some of those expectations in your interactions with people, people will come after you or there will be backlash and you need to stand strong and know that you are still right in going after what you want or communicating the way that you want. And I think that's a really important message to think about, not to just shrink back and fall back into conformity.
Yeah, that is hard work. Let me bring Andra Gillespie in here, too. She's an associate professor of political science at Emory University and the author of Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope, with us from Atlanta. Professor, welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
You heard what Professor Alfaro was just saying, that any woman, now we know it's Senator Harris, who stepped into this role, you know, 36 years after Geraldine Ferraro did it, 8 years after Sarah Palin did it, and of course Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket, wants to acknowledge that some things have changed, but a lot of what we're talking about, this kind of innate belief about women in leadership and ambition has not changed. And those are powerful forces up against, well, someone like Senator Harris today, are they not?
Yes, and I think it's actually really important to point out sort of there's a normative side of this, and then there's a more empirical side of this. So we have to ask the question of how does this affect, you know, vote preferences?
Sure.
And so just because women, you know, controlling for all else, have equal chances as men of getting elected, the problem is often they're not asked to run, so they don't run. That doesn't mean that the challenges that individual female candidates face are going to be unique and are going to be very specific related to their gender. And I think that that's actually a really normative problem there, right? Why is it that people think that they can use gender to tax against female candidates?
Right.
Is that appropriate? Should we be standing up against that in our society? So I think that that's the bigger question as opposed to whether or not it's going to cost Joe Biden votes.
I was thinking about Stacey Abrams, too, who was an early recipient as she got into the mix here as a potential pick for Biden. An early recipient of the kind of taxes we've just talked about. And I went looking for some of the coverage, and I came across this. I saw the terms brazen and oddball and unqualified applied to Abrams as if, you know, she had the temerity to suggest that she would be qualified for this job and wanted it. But then I found this from a New York Times article about her. Beyond her resume, critics have questioned Ms. Abrams' unwillingness to play the game, to act as though her ambition is an afterthought, a candor some Democrats have objected to, especially in light of reports that Mr. Biden does not view her as a top contender. Representative William Lacey Clay, a Missouri Democrat, said in April he found Ms. Abrams' lobbying for the job offensive and inappropriate. I do want to point out that Congressman Clay lost his primary last week to a young woman of color named Cori Bush. But Professor Gillespie, what do you hear in the reaction to Stacey Abrams' open ambition and open acknowledgement of her qualifications for the job?
Well, I mean, so, you know, I think that there are some substantive things there. And then, you know, I also sort of want to sort of get at sort of the specific things that relate to her resume. I think, you know, in general, people were very uncomfortable with the fact that she was open about saying that she would love to be considered for vice president of the United States. And I think some people took that as actually kind of, you know, being arrogant. And if we think about that in terms of race and gender terms,
yeah.
You know, it sort of fit into tropes that have long been existent in American society and in popular culture about people of color, black women getting out of their place, getting uppity. And so we want to try to avoid sort of falling into those types of traps. You know, there were larger questions, and I think part of the reason why Stacey Abrams and even my mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, ultimately weren't chosen as vice president compared to Kamala Harris because of the lack of statewide experience. And I think that that's a legitimate question to have, and I think that there's a way to raise that in a meaningful way. But to dismiss Stacey Abrams as being a lightweight when she definitely didn't demonstrate that in her own run for governor in 2018, and to say that she is, you know, out of place or too ambitious, that becomes problematic in terms of race and gender.
There was a real, Professor Alfaro, a real discomfort. I thought this was really refreshing that the people that were interested in the VP job, and why shouldn't they be, right? If you're in politics, not a bad gig, given the fact that, you know, if Biden's elected, he probably won't serve two terms. Why shouldn't you be openly ambitious about it? But it really gets to something with our discomfort with women that express open ambition. What else did you see going on there?
Yeah, you know, I saw a couple of different things going on there. Certainly there was, as Professor Gillespie was talking about, you know, some typical politics. There was jockeying for a plum position that I think all agree, like you said, will be, you know, available in 4 years.
Right.
If, you know, Biden wins the election. So I think there's some typical political jockeying, and I think there's a way that it could be done. I think the other thing that I saw with regard to kind of the state level experience, you know, versus the ambition argument was also reflected in Karen Bass and how Karen Bass was kind of rolled out late as an alternative to Kamala Harris, right? And so Karen Bass was you know, and she had to explicitly confront the idea that I am not the anti-Kamala Harris. We are, in fact, two sides of the same coin, meaning you're getting somebody who's just as qualified and just as outspoken, you know, when you look at me as well. And so I think that was another thing that I saw in the debate around who would become the vice president. There was this, well, if it can't be this openly ambitious person and it can't be this person who we think is openly ambitious, we need to find somebody who seems like they have no ambition. You know, like we have to find the opposite of the spectrum.
Right.
And that was really just shocking, as much as Karen Bass, you know, used to be my representative. And so, you know, I know what kind of ambition and what kind of strength she would bring to any table she joined.
And had to reach the kinds of positions that she reached, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a conversation, if you're just getting in on it this morning. It's the newest episode in our What It Means to Be a Woman in America. It's observing the 100 years of women's suffrage. And I have to admit, we were hoping that we would learn Vice President Biden's choice for his VP on this day when we were committed to having this conversation. So it's worked out really well. We're asking the questions about whether Senator Harris is going to encounter, I think we can just say yes, Senator Harris is going to encounter many of the deeply embedded gender-based stereotyping that Geraldine Ferraro encountered, that Sarah Palin encountered, that Hillary Clinton encountered in 2016, and how voters have to, I guess, be aware of the kind of social conditioning that we're immersed in the way that we see women who are politically ambitious. Thus, I went back and I grabbed a couple of questions from a Pew Research poll that is trying to get at voter attitudes about this. And here's a couple of the questions that they asked. Do you think men or women leaders are better at being persuasive in a political setting? You know, spoiler alert here, men come out on top of that question. Do you think men or women leaders are more comfortable with taking risks? I bet you can guess what Americans say about that, but I'd be curious about how you wrestle with that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR to Alexander in Rochester. Hi, Alexander. Glad you called.
Thanks for taking my call. My sister and I, she's 70s, and I call her a Gloria Steinem activist. She and I both agree that it doesn't matter anymore. This country and this world has moved so far ahead when it comes to gender, race, and age, generally speaking, and financial position. We don't feel that those items matter as much as the issues. And her issues are the same as mine, and I'm very conservative. Healthcare without insurance companies, she's been bankrupt because of her health issues later in life.
Your sister,
she
you
doesn't,
mean. Yeah.
Yep. And I've had, my children have had some issues that have financially put us in a difficult spot. Plus, I do business internationally, and these free trade deals have been the worst thing for manufacturing and jobs in the U.S. And last but not least, this military budget. I mean, whoever thought going into a war and staying in there for 20 years, when Obama was going to bring the troops home, he just made it worse. And
so,
I see the same thing my sister sees, that it's the issues that are more important, not gender, race, and age.
So, Alexander, I really appreciate that perspective. Professor Gillespie, I think voters, and yes, I wouldn't say that issues aren't a catalyzing force in the way voters coalesce around a candidate. But what we're really getting at here is the underlying kind of subconscious social conditioning. So what do you think when you hear Alexander say that?
Well, I mean, there are ways where gender doesn't predict voting behavior. So, for instance, if we are looking at support for women candidates and we throw partisanship into the mix, we don't see Democratic women defecting to support Republican women and vice versa, right, because party matters. And so, I mean, we could argue that partisanship is a proxy for substance in terms of people sort of identifying issues that might align better with the Democratic Party platform versus the Republican Party platform. But we have to think about why descriptive representation is important. Why is it important to see women in positions of leadership, to see racial and ethnic minorities in positions of leadership, to see people coming from all different backgrounds at all kinds of walks of life? There is a certain lived experience that imparts an expertise that can actually enliven deliberative debates about healthcare and about trade and other types of issues. So let's just use healthcare as an example. At one point, when Obamacare was being debated, there was an all-male panel that was making decisions about things that affected women's health.
Oh my gosh,
And it's not that men can't be sensitive to those issues, but the fact that there were women who were available who could provide expertise and actually personal knowledge of these issues but weren't being invited to the table suggested and lended a certain air of illegitimacy to the debate. And so it's really important. And I think if we look at sort of what gender representation looks like in our national legislature, women are still underrepresented, but there's more parity on the Democratic side than on the Republican side. So what does it mean for conservative women to not see very many people who look like them in positions of power, right? That's demobilizing. That makes it difficult for them to be able to have an outsized voice. So this is not sort of let's, you know, all just make sure that we, you know, count the right number of people who check all the right boxes.
Right.
It's also making sure that we're actually giving people power and giving people voice so that they can make the contributions that they have been empowered to make by their lives.
Call here from Nancy in Maple Grove. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Yeah, my question, well, this is more of a comment. The third female vice presidential candidate we've had was Winona LaDuke.
Ah,
ran with,
another Minnesota connection, Nancy.
Yeah.
You are right. Ran with Ralph Nader.
Yeah,
that's
if anybody
right.
had, you know, sections she could speak about race and diversity and everything. She was
yeah.
a wonderful speaker.
I'm really
to vote for.
Yeah, I'm really glad you called and mentioned Winona LaDuke. She stayed in politics for a long time. I should have been saying, I was using the term main party politics. I guess I should have included the Green Party there. So, Nancy, thank you for the call. Conversation this morning with Ange Marie Hancock Alfaro. She's a professor and chair of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California, and Andra Gillespie, an associate professor of political science at Emory University. And a discussion here, a new episode of our What It Means to Be a Woman in America 100 years after women got the vote, and taking stock of how some things have changed since Geraldine Ferraro accepted the nomination as vice president and Sarah Palin did in 2012 and Hillary Clinton was at the top of the ticket. But a lot of the deep-seated ways that we see women in leadership, not just in politics, but also in business, have not changed. And this is something that Senator Harris is going to have to reckon with on the campaign trail. So that's our conversation this morning. Your calls and questions, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Back to the conversation now. And Mallory says on Twitter, you know, I agree with the caller. As much as I'd love to see a woman president, I care much more about the issues. She adds, we need Medicare for all. I don't care who gets us there. We just need it now. And Hatley tweets, so many comments about how the most qualified person should be chosen, not someone based on their race or gender. It's not a coincidence that all other VPs have been white men. So I'd argue that race and gender have always played a role in who was chosen. And to the phones to Monica in St. Paul. Hey, Monica, glad you called in. What are you turning over here in this conversation?
Hi. I guess I'm wondering what your guests have to say about how to combat some of this, because I feel like it's so deeply ingrained. And what I want to share is right after the announcement yesterday, I actually missed it because I was taking a brief little afternoon nap. But when I woke up and was trying to figure out what was going on, I went to NPR, which is, you know, my news of choice. And just the image of on your webpage and on the Facebook page was the one in which Kamala and Biden were kind of in the heat of the debate when they, you know, when she was kind of talking to him about racism, you know, that
yeah,
image.
Yeah.
So just that alone just reinforces some of the negative, just the sexism, and how do we combat that when even NPR is kind of perpetuating this, in my opinion?
I think it's a really good question, and I had a note here for our guests, so let's get to it, about how the media can do better. So let's take it straight on. Professor Alfaro, how can I and public media and the media at large, the serious media, do better?
Well, I think one thing, and this is a challenge, I think, just for this historical moment, as much as this is also a challenge with regard to racism and sexism in the media. So I think two things are coming together to create a perfect storm. So the media will have to do better. So I just want to note that, right, that it's not solely media bias that's going on here.
Right.
I think the really important thing is to think about all aspects of the presentation, right, and all aspects of the newsroom, right? So National Association of Black Journalists and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists have just had their convention for this year, and they've talked a lot about how diversifying the newsroom, to go back to Professor Gillespie's point, actually means that the decision calculus is different in all aspects of the newsroom. So it's not just, you know, the guests that you're going to find to come on the show, but it's also who's controlling the ways that the online content is, you know, actually put on. So what photograph is being selected, what headline is being written. That's been another very, very big one when it comes to this particular presidential campaign, you know, the ways in which headlines are being written. So I think those are some of the things that it really does matter who is in the room, who is making those editorial decisions. Because again, when you have that diversity of experience, and research has shown when you have diversity at the leadership helm, better decisions are made that actually have a better impact on the bottom line. So it's not just a matter of are we getting it right or wrong, you know, from a moral perspective,
right,
but it's also are we getting it right or wrong in a way that helps the media organization gain respect and continue to be economically viable. So the two things can work together.
Yeah, Professor Gillespie, I hear that. I also think there is just lazy political reporting and analysis that goes on. Now, some of it you're going to get off cable news, and I think it's hard to control for that because it's just a bunch of people talking, you know, 24/7. But I also think there are just political journalists fall back on some of the easy analysis. I mean, you go back and you read some of the autopsies of the coverage of Hillary Clinton, and you see a lot of tropes and a lot of just, you know, easy, lazy analysis disguised as, well, this is the way politics is and it's the way it's always been. How do we do better with that?
Well, I think one of the first things we need to do is to call out such lazy thinking and falling back on stereotypes and tropes in real time.
Okay.
Part of that is to neutralize it in the minds of voters so that they realize that they should actually be discounting that. That doesn't happen enough. It needs to happen more. You know, I would argue that putting more academics in analyst positions would actually help to combat that.
Hurrah!
Especially people who are trained. I'm not just sort of tooting our own horn here, but like, there's a reason we study this stuff, and so we might point it out a little bit more readily if you put the right people in who actually study this stuff. You know, if I want to provide an example of something that should be combated, and I'm saying this preemptively, in order to sort of, you know, think about this, you know, we know that Kamala Harris dated Willie Brown, who was mayor of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely going to come up more, and it could come up in a really pernicious way. So people should be on their guard when that comes up, especially if it comes up in a salacious way, to say, nope. Who she dated back, you know, 25 years ago is immaterial to what
right.
she's doing now and who she is.
But you're warning us that you're going to see coverage of that.
I would not be surprised. I would be prepared for it, and I think that editors and journalists and analysts need to be prepared with a response to shut that conversation down because it's completely unnecessary.
Christina tweets here at me, how can the media do better? Will you do a show on how to correctly pronounce Kamala? I'm hearing it mispronounced on both NPR and NPR. It is Kamala, okay? Not Kamala, not Kamala, Kamala. Okay, to the phones to TJ in Salt Lake. Hi, DJ. Thanks so much for waiting here. I appreciate that.
No problem. And once a Minnesotan, always a Minnesotan. Haley from Salt Lake.
Thank you. I'll be brief.
I just wanted to pose something kind of simple. It's such an interesting set of data that suggests that people are more upset or, you know, unsettled with the notion of a woman trying to achieve a position of power, politics, corporate, whatever.
Yeah.
Than they are once they're there. And that's what made me think through this and decide to call in. And I just want to, I don't want to posit this to be, you know, my thought or anyone's thought, but let me throw this out there and I'd love to hear some feedback. Kind of a simple idea is so many of us were raised by mothers in two situations, either with a father who went off and went to work every day, or sadly, more and more so, single mother homes where there was no father. So socially, I think a lot of us possibly could be ingrained with the idea that, hey, now wait a minute. That's a mother who's not doing what I know a mother should be doing or trying to be doing something that a mother, as I know a mother should be. But then, you know, once they're there and they're doing the great job and all that, it's like, we're over it, okay? It's just the idea that maybe somewhere subconsciously some of us are like, hey, you're supposed to be a mom.
That we're being influenced by parental. No, I let's take this to our guests. I think this sounds reasonable. Professor Alfaro, what do you think? Traditional parental roles also influence the way we think.
I think that's true, and I think for someone like Kamala Harris, now I'm doing this.
I put that in your head. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think for somebody like Kamala Harris, this is a very complicated question, and I think it's true for a lot of Black women in politics, simply because, you know, when you look at sociological details like, you know, marital rates and other types of things in terms of childbearing, there are racial as well as gender differences in how that plays out for a lot of Black women. And so, you know, for someone like Kamala Harris, she is not a biological mother, but has been for several years a stepmother and has talked very much about that role, right? And so I think, you know, when you think about should this be a mother, I think there's definitely a race and a gender kind of intersectional tie there. I think there's also a long history of looking at Black women as a particular kind of mother, a mammy or a bad mother. And so I think media representations of those things, anything from Gone with the Wind up to Precious more recently, are things that do shape how people look at Black women when they actually enter into the political arena. And so even though Karen Bass is absolutely nobody's caretaker, certainly the way that she was posited as the kind of anti-Kamala Harris was that, you know, she's the mom that you can feel safe with, right? Because she doesn't have this ambition. She's going to be a caretaker and do what's necessary, but not be threatening in any way, shape, or form to the status quo.
That's absolutely the other undertone. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the minute she said that she did not aspire to be president, she was held up as this shining example of what a woman VP really ought to be.
Professor, and that's what mothers do. They sacrifice. Right.
Professor Gillespie, I wanted to get this in. Is this also about having and seeing women of color stepping into new spaces and having white America, you know, be required to adjust to that? I mean, I was reading an article about our own Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, her new book, and she won her primary. And she describes, now I know this has happened to a lot of women, but this probably also happens to a lot of women of color. She describes being told by Minnesota political leaders that she had to wait her turn. You know, you just are not high enough on the pecking order to run for office. Do you see that at play here?
I certainly see it at play, and this is something that Black male politicians have, you know, encountered before. So, you know, I can recall Doug Wilder talking about having been told to wait his turn when he wanted to run for statewide office, not even governor, for lieutenant governor of Virginia, in the mid-1980s. And so this is often a trope that's used to stall ambitious candidates from marginalized backgrounds from taking, you know, leadership positions that they are more than qualified in taking. But I think that there's also a psychological adjustment, and this is a psychological adjustment for people who are on the left.
Mm-hmm.
you know, Dr. Alfaro, you know, is very well versed and writes about intersectionality. In fact, has written one of the seminal pieces trying to define that for a political science audience. And one of the things that we have to deal with in terms of how we think about gender and politics is that gender is often viewed as white, so women are white. And African-Americans are men, to sort of use a common phrasing I think we attributed to Joyce Ladner. And so this idea that Kamala Harris now becomes the most prominent woman Democrat mm-hmm. in the country who is in a very strong position to be able to run for president in her own right, thus making her the one to break the glass ceiling,
yeah.
right? That takes some adjustment, even for people who might find themselves being liberal. I think that was what actually undergirded Chris Dodd's resistance. It was, wow, this just sort of completely upended my notion of second-wave feminism. And I expected it was going to be an upper-middle-class white baby boomer woman. It's like, well, yeah, no, it might not be, actually. And people are going to have to adjust with that and learn to check their privilege, even if they think that they're actually quite liberal and progressive in their point of view.
You know, I've thought about this with the popularity of Michelle Obama, who is going to speak, of course, I think on the first night of the Democratic Convention. She is one of the most, if not the most popular women in America, and I thought, I wonder how that status would change if she had expressed in any way some ambition, some political ambition. I mean, Professor Alfaro, that first she would have been seen as much more partisan than she is apparently seen this way. But I also think what Professor Gillespie just described would be immediately attributed to Michelle Obama, and perceptions would change pretty quickly. Yeah? What would you say?
Yes. I mean, I agree 100% that perceptions would change pretty quickly. And, you know, she talks about in her book, Becoming, she talks about the way in which, you know, as kind of a novice person out on the campaign trail in 2007 and in 2008, prior to the first presidential election, she really had to figure out how she was going to communicate that she was not that person,
yeah.
right? And so if you remember, you know, her frame was she wanted to be mom in chief. Huh. That was going to be her role. And she really needed to distinguish. Now, partly that has to do with things that happened during the 1990s with Hillary Clinton, right? And again, this discomfort with women's ambition
right.
and with women's qualifications. But I think the other piece of it was, you know, this other piece that also includes race about the ways in which, you know, we need to rule you out so that we can rule other people in. And in that case, it was ruling out Michelle Obama so that we could accept Barack Obama.
Wow. Do you remember when Michelle Obama gave that speech and said that this was the first time she was proud of America, and how infuriated and how inflamed the reaction was, as if
yes.
a woman of color did not have a right to say that America did not live up to its promise?
Yeah, that was one of the pieces that she talks about, where she says, you know, again, this idea that I couldn't be as candid as I would normally be, you know, in terms of being fully herself, was a real challenge and a real wake-up call to her. Because, again, in most contexts, we would expect that given the history of African Americans, given the history of women, you know, in this country, there could be pleasant surprise, frankly, about the ways in which, you know, a candidate like Barack Obama or a candidate like Hillary Clinton was doing, you know, in any primary situation or in a general election. And so to know that the country has actually progressed a little bit further, at least in terms of candidates and voting, maybe not in terms of systemic issues, and being able to express that pleasant surprise, I think, was surprising to her in terms of, I thought we were further along, and me saying that I thought we were further along
yeah.
generates more controversy.
A call here from Gretchen in Bloomington. Hi, Gretchen. Good to have you on the line.
Hi, thanks.
Hi. What are you thinking about?
Well, I was calling about what you were talking about earlier with the lived experience and people calling about qualifications
right.
and that they're more interested in the issues. And one of the things that I was thinking about was we don't really question what the narrative is on who is qualified and what makes somebody qualified. And I think that we need to really consider that lived experience is a qualification in and of itself. And, you know, what actually makes somebody an effective leader and what actually makes somebody an effective governing person might actually be different than what the current narrative is.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Professor Gillespie?
I think that that's fair. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that there are some limits to descriptive representation that are structural, for instance. So adults make decisions about children all the time. Legally and developmentally, that makes sense, but it also means that we don't put children in positions of leadership to tell us their stories. But it also sort of evinces a certain level of sensitivity to issues. And so lived experience can actually bring out some of those sensitivities to issues where people can speak based on experience. But we also have to consider the ways that people make decisions, oftentimes without consultation with the communities that they that are going to be directly affected by those decisions. So if you have somebody who comes from a completely privileged decision who presumes to understand how their policy proposals are going to affect certain communities but doesn't actually make an effort to go out and reach into those communities, that's going to cause a problem. And so we, you know, it's not perfect, but if sometimes people who come from those communities, either by just natural socialization and experience, mm-hmm. are more likely to consult with those communities, or they're actually more readily able to pull from their own experience to say, you know what, I've had this happen in my life before. Here's how I think this policy is going to play out if we actually implement it in this way.
You know, I wanted to run something by you both. I was looking at some archived interviews with Geraldine Ferraro as I was preparing for the show. She died in 2011. She described what it was like to get out on the campaign trail and be asked questions like whether she could make a good blueberry muffin. And she said, sure can you? And I thought, you know, the sexism is... I don't think women will encounter those kinds of things, and this is going to be a very different campaign. So I think the sexism might be more subtle, but you know, I would think that Kamala Harris will run into some of these deep kind of tropes and attitudes that Geraldine Ferraro did and Sarah Palin did many years later. You know, how do you, I guess, Professor Alfaro, how will we measure at the end of this whether the progress has actually been made, aside from, yes, she ends up getting elected with Vice President Biden?
Well, I think one thing that we want to be able to do, and this was a challenge that I know Sarah Palin actually tweeted at Kamala Harris to, you know, remain her authentic self and not be bullied just in the past 24 hours. I think that's really going to be the gold standard, right? Rather than trying to say we can never ask about cooking or we can always ask about cooking, you know, Kamala Harris happens to be a candidate that enjoys cooking. And so, you know, we should be able to ask questions about the candidate that are authentic to who the candidate is without actually using them as a standard. So whether or not she cooks should not be a standard for whether she can serve as Vice President of the United States. But learning that she loves cooking and inviting her to a cooking demonstration online or something like that should be authentic to who she is. And I do think that the idea of using lived experience as a standard can be really helpful. So for example, Kamala Harris, when she was state attorney general, she, as a woman state attorney general, cleared the backlog of rape kits. Yeah. And that was not something that any male attorney general was focused on across the 50 states when she did it. And so her lived experience, both as a prosecutor, but also as a woman navigating late nights, dark nights, all kinds of things that women navigate, helped her know that that needed to be a priority long before it broke in the media.
I really hate to end this conversation. This has been so great. Thank you both. Good to have you on.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. and thanks.